keep it.
Hello. You didn't have anything to add to that. We're simply back.
No, because we're under attack.
Bye.
The Civil War has begun.
Oh, that's true. Yes.
Yeah.
It's a competition between people who believe bigly is a word and don't. So pick your sides now. Find your cutlass.
We have someone new drafted into the war with us today.
I'm so happy to be here. I think I've been training for this for years.
Well, Winter Mitchell, we are happy to have you here.
I'm thrilled. Thank you for having me. Thank you both.
Winter Mitchell and I were both, I would fill in for Guy Branum on the podcast, Pop Rocket. Mm-hmm. Winter Mitchell, a scholar of pop culture.
Studied for a long time.
Well, Pop Rocket is dead.
Indeed.
It was the first victim of the war.
At Lexington, the shots. We're now mixing wars. I introduced her at the time. I got to host the podcast, and I got to say, Summer Wishes Winter Mitchell.
Yes.
Have you ever seen that movie, Summer Wishes Winter Dreams, with Joanne Woodward? And this is such an amazing 60s dead reference, Martin Balsam. He's the guy who dies
Martin
on the steps in Psycho. Yeah.
Okay, but he's also, wasn't he also in...
12 Angry Men.
But was he married to Bette Davis?
No, he was married to, good question. His daughter is Talia Balsam.
Who was married to
George Clooney.
George Clooney first.
Yes, and now is married to John Slattery, and she was on Mad Men as his wife.
I always wonder what they would have been like if they stayed married.
Oh, I know, right.
You know what I mean? I kind of feel like...
Because she was, I think, maybe older than George Clooney.
When I put them together, like, in my mind now, I just don't see it because he's so how he is about
right.
it all.
Can I say she upgraded?
She 100% upgraded.
I think John Slattery is so much hotter than George Clooney.
I feel like George Clooney would bother her at this point.
Yeah.
Just, like, the whole, the maelstrom of it all would just be, like, annoying to her. I feel like John Slattery is, like, you know,
he reads
fun.
Pretty cool.
He reads books. He drinks, you know, like whiskey neat.
Yes.
It's just like how
and he's a- and he's aging the way he wants to mm-hmm. be, not like reluctantly.
Yeah, I think that Amal is at home trying to like she's reading, I don't know, Ronan Farrow's book, and George comes over and he's like,
"Let's go to Lake Como and take the speedboat with Johnny Depp." And she's like, "That is so D-class A."
She's like, "Get out of here."
John Slattery to me looks like the man in the yellow hat from Curious George. Just that exact silhouette, like tall rectangle
He's
head.
Jaunty in a way that's not annoying.
Yeah, right. It's organic.
It's organic.
I would like to see him with just a yellow hat on.
Oh, yeah.
Yes. Mm.
Who's
He's
curious
very sexy.
Now?
I think I honestly fell in love with him on Desperate Housewives.
What season was he on,
like,
to be honest?
Three.
Yeah, that's when I started like watching it.
Gabrielle.
Right. That's when I started watching it while being on my cell phone. So I didn't really take in it. Like, I didn't even know they switched out, like, Gardner boys. It was really good for, like, a solid 40, 50 episodes.
Yeah.
You know?
Which is all you can expect in this
Which
life.
Exactly. And, right, you know, it's interesting. I was just reading about their Entertainment Weekly shoot. Remember that?
Yep. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Or was it Vanity Fair? What shoot was it where they were just fighting, like cats and dogs?
I think it was Vanity Fair.
It was Vanity Fair.
Yes.
I don't know why. I think it was because of...
Well, they were pushing, for the first season, like, Terry Hatcher's the star of this show.
And it's like, and then, when you do that, you should know, like, from Friends, like, with Courtney Cox, you shouldn't do stuff like that.
Yeah, because
you
quickly...
Just, yeah, quickly, people are like...
The viewers weren't into her.
We're not into you. We love you, but we kind of like these other people, too, who've been booted off of, like, 70 failed pilots.
Yeah.
That is always so interesting about Courtney Cox being the purported star of Friends when it started, because... Nothing about that character was demanding to be, like, the center of attention in that way.
Exactly.
It's so interesting. Yeah.
But then she was really the, I feel like, wasn't she the star throughout the show, though? Because she was the one with the biggest film career.
No, that's what I mean. That's when Friends began, they were like, well, Courtney Cox is obviously the one you've heard of. You know?
Yes. And then Scream and stuff happened.
Yeah, right.
But I think that she learned her lesson because of all the Friends, she's putting forth the most effort on social media. I will give her that. She's like pulling out all the stops, doing all the boomerangs.
No, but does that mean she has to do that and Jennifer Aniston and Lisa Kudrow don't?
I think Jennifer Aniston, I was just thinking when I was walking here with my Topo Chico, I love Topo Chico, refreshing seltzer drink.
I love how you were thinking of her while drinking a different water brand.
That's what I was thinking about, because I was thinking to myself, God, if I were a smart water representative, I'd be so annoyed that this is the person we pay $30 million a year when she literally walks outside five times a year on like on solstices, on like full waning moons. Like she doesn't come outside. So like how, you know what I mean? Like it's annoying.
That is, I do want to ascend to the level of fame where... it is considered a sort of like a solstice event when I am drinking water in public.
Also, Courtney Cox probably learned that social media stuff from Busy Phillips. But speaking of Jennifer Aniston,
yeah.
I would love to see that memoir.
You know,
that's me segueing into the fact that we'll be talking about Demi Moore's memoir today.
Oh, God.
Let's keep it book club.
Can I tell you, like, the amount of preparation I did without even knowing, before I was even booked and busy on this show, that I did going into the Demi of it all? I've loved her since forever, since before you all were born.
That's honestly what I encountered while reading this book was thinking about, do I love her? Like, I had forgotten whether I did. We can get into that.
Anyway, Demi Moore.
Yes.
We're going to talk about that.
Yes.
We're also going to talk about the disrespect to Debbie Harry.
Oh, right.
But I kind of have a counter. I feel like she kind of disrespected herself.
Okay.
Some of her stories are a little...
Okay, well, we will get to that.
It was a dicey time, Winter.
Okay.
I'm like, did that happen, girl?
And then Lewis and I have a exciting interview with Gia Tolentino.
Who is a frighteningly good writer.
Yes, an authoress, if you will.
I put both my hands on my temples as I read her, because you have to, like, zoom in to what she is talking. It's very 100%. Intensely smart.
Are you gazing into the future, Raven?
Yes, it's me, Maria Uspenskaya in the 30s. Back when every character had somebody with a... Every movie had a character with a crystal ball.
Yes, like The Letter.
Right, yes. Oh, good times.
Anyway.
Speaking of Bette Davis.
This is our show. I don't know what we've gotten ourselves into, but we'll be right back. Last week, actress and provocateur.
Sure.
The original provocateur. Agent provocateur 001. Demi Moore published her memoir, Inside Out, in which she opens up about her marriages, her substance abuse, her childhood, and many other things. Listen, I was reading this by the pool in Palm Springs this weekend, which I feel like is ideal to read celebrity 3,000%.
Memoirs. 1,000%.
Because it's about luxuriating.
Right. And, girl, this was a book.
Mm-hmm.
From the jump, it was wild. What do we think?
She is... You know what's interesting about her? This book was missing shit. There are things that I know occurred that she did not add into this book. But just the juice that she dropped was enough for me. And I kept thinking to myself, we haven't had like a good celeb memoir in a minute.
It's a dying art.
It's a dying art.
I'm gratified just that we have enough to talk about here on Keep It.
Mm-hmm.
Because, I mean, if I could, I would turn this whole thing into a celeb memoir podcast, you know, and a hostile takeover. But I was going to say, I was disappointed in the press about this book that so many people are focused on the Ashton Kutcher of it all. When that is not a fascinating era of Demi Moore
at
to
all.
Me.
No.
I'm more interested in the Brat Packiness and specifically the time in the 90s when she was getting so much money for movies that did so badly.
Yes. Yes.
Like, when you think, like, when's the last time anybody watched The Scarlet Letter? Which, that's like the last definitive movie version of that. And she started it with Gary Oldman, and it is the pits.
It is a horrifically bad movie.
Yes.
I mean, I feel like she spent a good chunk of time on Blame It on Rio, and I appreciated that.
No, I like that too. Yes.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like,
just
that was nice.
Talking about being in Brazil, doing cocaine every day.
Every day, looking for it, hunting for it.
With her friend ZZ?
Yes, who she's still friends with to this day.
Yes.
I love how she adds that. Just like, she's like, don't talk anymore about anything else that happened during the shoot for Blame It on Rio.
So she spends a lot of time on Blame It on Rio, and I am actually waiting for another memoir from her. Because when we interviewed Kathleen Turner, I remember she had a memoir, but she also had Kathleen Turner on acting.
Right.
And so someone interviewed her about each movie she'd done.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel like for actresses like Demi, like people who are really like big actors being paid so much money, like they were Hollywood stars, I would love just a book of someone being like, all right, No Small Affair. Okay.
Right.
One Crazy Summer. Okay. The Butcher's Wife.
Because my
Butcher's Wife.
Oh my God. Which legendary movie poster. If you look at her, I'm like,
yes.
That's her?
Yes.
She's blonde on the cover of that
yes.
movie. In that same vein, Ira, my favorite part of the book is when she is talking about the filming of the movie Indecent Proposal. And
yes. Okay.
The director of that movie during
Adrian
sex
Lynn.
Scenes is screaming things like, ooh, that gave me a boner.
Yeah.
It's really,
fucking
really
raunchy.
Disgusting.
And she's like, very 80s about it.
Yes.
Yes.
She's like, ultimately, it was helpful to the scene. I was like, not to me.
Not to me.
So,
she mentions it again when she goes, when she goes to dinner with Sharon Tate's husband.
Oh, yes. Roman Polanski.
Roman Polanski, sorry.
So, the book has a lot of, these are the sensibilities of a woman who came up in the 80s, 90s.
In a very sexist Hollywood that treated her in a sexist way.
Yes. And you see from her upbringing, parents constantly fighting, splitting up, moving her everywhere, her mom's constant suicide attempts that were for attention, her dad being...
Not her dad.
Not being her dad and being also a scammer.
A scam, actually. Every single thing was a scam.
I'm like, I did know that you grew up in Paper Moon.
100%.
On the grift, constantly.
Right. And she talks about, being raped at a young age.
Yeah.
And I just think, and like her mom sort of being friends with that person and probably knowing about it.
Yeah.
And
getting paid
yes.
$500.
Yes. So there's a lot in here that's like, oh, this is kind of dark to see that this is her outlook on life because it's what her life and Hollywood just sort of beat into people during that era. Because before the Adrian Lynn movie, she talked with Glenn Close, and Glenn Close was like, just so you know, when I shot Fatal Attraction.
But he also directed.
Yes. Adrian was yelling the same things at me on set. And I'm like, that's not okay.
Yeah, it's really,
it's
really
creepy.
Frightening. Yeah. Also, when I was reading the book, I was reacquainted with the fact that Demi Moore is also somebody who, she was definitely A-list for a long time, but also never truly respected. As in, she got big projects and stuff, but she and Madonna were the reasons the Razzies existed. And I talked about this on an old Keep It years and years and years ago, but...
yes, Keep It, which famously started in 1983.
The finale of MASH, we started right there. But I always thought the Razzies were gently ribbing male stars, like Sylvester Stallone, what a joke,
yeah.
And nobody thought Sylvester Stallone was anything. Meanwhile, they would like harangue female stars for
sure.
Trying to be taken seriously.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I feel like Demi Moore is like the epitome of that, of somebody who just got bad scripts, maybe took on some bad scripts, gave performances that some thought were wooden, but she got an outsized amount of criticism for those.
Mm-hmm.
She was seen as bossy and entitled.
But the thing is that she was one of the few actresses who didn't have to audition that much.
Yeah.
And then she can just go and say, I want to do this. And they'd be like, sure, yes. And people just gave her what she wanted. And sometimes it was a win. Sometimes it made sense. And sometimes it was like her just thinking, this is going to be the best thing ever. Like Striptease. I went back and revisited Striptease. And I thought, today it would probably still flop.
Yeah.
But it wasn't as terrible as people, considering that Showgirls was right around that era. I feel like it wasn't as bad as people made it out to be. But I also felt like it was a huge fuck you, because if you think about it, right before that, it was all of those photos of her out on the beach after she had Tallulah.
Right.
Of her being not in the best shape. And that was her chance to sort of be like, well, F you. I'm going to look great, and I'm going to option this story and make it into this film and get paid the most. And like pay equity, women weren't talking about pay equity mm-hmm. like that. And she was also one of the first to sort of be out there, talking about getting top billing, equal pay, all the things.
Mm-hmm. I mean, speaking of striptease, Armand Asante.
Right, yeah. This is the Armand Asante hour, I guess.
There was this idea that she was one of those actresses who really was celeb culture, right?
Yeah.
You know, you think about actresses now who, like, we revere, you know, mm-hmm. sort of like a Sally Field or something, right? It's like they are famous because they're an actress.
Yeah.
And we see their movies and they win awards. And then there are people who are famous because they are in the tabloids.
They were glamorous, like, thinking, also in movies.
Thinking like a J-Lo.
Yeah.
Like, J-Lo would have been very much Demi Moore if she were older.
I think a good 90s corollary would be Sharon Stone. Mm-hmm. Like, people could not shut the fuck up about Sharon Stone. And now you could probably name four main movies of Sharon Stone's from that time, you know?
Yeah. Whereas J-Lo,
J-Lo's
now in an era where she's able to make savvier choices and actually be in sort of good movies.
Mm-hmm.
Or we sort of even respect the dumb movies she does because they're fun and we like her, as opposed to these bad movies.
But then she can also look aspirational. Like, mm-hmm. the lifestyle is an aspirational thing. Like, for Demi, it was like the movie star action hero husband, you know, the three girls having, like, being like a mom, being beautiful, just being breathtaking,
right.
mm-hmm. and always sort of serving it up. Like, when we think about Ghost, where she wasn't the best part of Ghost, but she certainly wasn't the worst part mm-hmm. of Ghost.
Yeah, she was fine in Ghost.
She was fine in Ghost.
Mm-hmm. It's so interesting hearing her talk about, like, Ghost and, like, A Few Good Men.
Yeah.
And
you forget.
Talk about how she was honored to be on the set with so many these actors. Like, she talks in Decent Proposal, she keeps being like, you know, I was on screen with a legend, Robert Redford. And it really just sounds like this woman, yeah, who's been not respected. And she felt like it was just, you know, sort of an honor for her to be allowed on the set.
Right. No, there's a part in the book where she talks about how she met Andy Warhol recently in the 80s and then invited him to her wedding. And then she heard through the grapevine that he was so flattered to be invited.
Yeah.
Like, that is that it's weird to hear it from her perspective because you can tell she's bewildered by it. You know, she's never for one second like, and of course he should feel honored to be invited to my wedding. She's mm-hmm. like, no, I don't know what the deal was.
Right, which makes the incident with Vanity Fair seem so shocking, right? Because the interview came out, the one that accompanied her nude pregnant photograph by Miss Leibovitz. She talks about how the interview, though, was like, Demi Moore is a bitch. She's bossy, you know, like causing trouble upset. And I feel like
it was such
that's how she thought that people perceived her so much.
But do y'all remember that? Were you old enough to, like, were you guys old enough to remember?
I remember
that
the cover.
It was so, there was so much discussion about it for the longest, longest time. It just, and I'm an old lady. But there was so many conversations on morning news, evening news, nightly news, late night. There was, I remember going to the grocery store and it was covered up. Like, you knew what it, you knew what it looked like, but all the stores had covered it up.
Mm-hmm.
And I just think, like, that's why she's an icon, because today nobody would even care about that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, right. No, you see a magazine cover like that once every couple months.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. That's what you do.
Sports Illustrated has the new, whatever, the naked issue, whatever they do.
Yeah.
They all look like that.
They all look like that.
Mm-hmm.
It was beautiful, too, because I love that haircut of hers from that era, to be honest.
The one that she tried to get in Paris and they
right.
messed up.
Well, so that was a very funny exchange. She talks about how she wanted to get Isabella Rossellini's haircut.
So she went to Paris.
She was in Paris and they fucked it up and gave her that short haircut. And then she came back and asked a hairdresser friend, hi, can you fix this? And he was like, you know, I'm the one who did it. Rosalina's haircut.
Yeah.
Should have come to me first.
She got the miles, though.
Yeah, she did. When I think of Demi Moore, to be honest, there are two versions I think of her. I think of Ghost era short haircut.
Mm-hmm.
Just because I feel like Ghost was a film that was constantly in rotation at home. I watched Ghost a lot. And that movie used to freak me the fuck out, by the
really?
Way.
No, it made me cry.
Well, no, I was
the first
always,
time I cried in theaters was at Ghost.
I think one of the first nightmares I had that wasn't about Freddy Krueger
was being dragged away by those demons.
Yes, the demons
it really
dragging
has some scary
the villains to hell was a frightening moment.
And if I'm not mistaken, it's a PG movie or something. It's really frightening.
It might be PG-13. But I, you know what? That movie, she was right when in her description of that movie. It was quirky.
Yes.
Ghost is quirky.
I mean, it's, she was literally like, this is four different movies.
It's four different movies.
And then Whoopi Goldberg is just running around the movie being a scammer psychic.
Yes.
Yeah, she's sort of her own movie in and of herself. But I mean, obviously, what a wonderful performance and an Oscar winning performance.
Yes. Tony Goldwyn.
Mm-hmm. And it's funny too because she really is the least remembered thing about that movie. I mean, we remember Patrick Swayze.
Yes.
Because
it's Patrick Swayze. He did such good work.
And Whoopi, I mean, the most memorable thing from Ghost is Molly, you and Danger Girl.
Yes. So I think the bank scene is, to me, the Oscar clincher.
Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. But then the other Demi I remember, Ashton era.
Right.
But Charlie's Angels Full Throttle.
Which I think is comeback. Now, I want to say that is now her lasting iconic moment. As in, if you talk to somebody who's 24 years old, they're gonna bring that up.
I was never good. I was great.
I've actually never seen that movie. I don't think there's anything in it for
me. What? Charlie's Angels Full Throttle is a bop.
Meaning what?
She has a point. It's an icon. It's a legend. And it is the moment.
Yeah. No, I mean, she looks stunning, obviously.
I honestly don't think that movie would have worked without somebody like her in it. Because that movie is all over the frickin' place.
The Golden Gun.
There's so much going on in that film.
Justin Theroux is so fucking hot
in that movie. But there's also...
Speaking of Jennifer Aniston.
Speaking of... when they say Full Throttle, like, you watch Charlie's Angels, and then you see the sequel, and it's definitely, like, turned up.
Oh, I see.
It's volume hot. It's Shia LaBeouf's in it.
Yes.
Bruce Willis is in it. Mm-hmm. Like, there's so much going on. The story is all over the place. But Demi is... I went to the Charlie's Angels 2 premiere, and I remember just seeing, like, that was the first time her and Ashton and all the... And they all came together. And this was like the heyday of just like pop. This is like when pop culture
was the beginning of a Paris Hilton, et cetera.
Yes. Yeah. And then things were like starting to sort of like, you knew it was going to die soon because it can't get hotter than this. But she was, when they first got together, I like hearing like her inner monologue about what she felt like people thought and like how her agent who I think was Kevin Huvane at the time, mm-hmm. was basically telling her that being with Ashton is making her look desperate,
mm-hmm.
and like, you know, not serious, like not a serious actress. But mm-hmm. The only thing that makes me angry about that whole exchange, even though they were a hot couple, is how much energy and effort she put into him.
Mm-hmm.
He really sapped.
He
was not worth it.
It's also weird to see it so spelled out in the book. Like, she talks about how she was pressured into three ways with him to keep it alive, which is a very Jane Fonda, Roger Vadim era marriage concession.
Yeah. What's funny about the Charlie's Angels Full Throttle thing, by the way, is our friend Matt Rogers is mentioned in the book.
Yes.
Oh, right. As a young journalist who interviews her recently, I think at Sundance.
Yeah, she said, a young journalist interviewed me at Sundance and said that the moment where you say, I was never good, I was great, and a single tear rolls down your eye is his favorite moment from any film. And I remember I texted Matt and said, your favorite moment in any film, bitch.
I would say, slightly thirsty. You ever seen Citizen Kane, girl?
Yes.
I doubt Matt Rogers has seen Citizen Kane.
We can discuss that another time.
But he then mentioned that she's also a great crier in Ghost, you know, and like she's one of the iconic
single
criers
tier
in film. And she goes on a tangent about how, oh my God, I was so worried about crying in Ghost and now to be remembered as a crier on screen.
She's also a really great producer. She produced a lot of films. She produced Austin Powers, the Austin Powers series.
Interesting.
And she just doesn't get a lot of credit. I feel like, and from what it sounds like based on her book, I mean, she seems like a perfectly nice woman. I'm sure she had to make tough decisions and be that bitch in certain occasions. But I really don't see why people have always sort of mistreated her.
Yeah. I mean, she's like the epitome of somebody who was treated as overexposed almost immediately.
Yeah.
As in, like, she's like, you know, taking up too much of our time. But I would say what's interesting is in thinking about my favorite movies of hers, I would have to go with a more recent one. You ever seen Margin Call?
I haven't. No. Maybe I should.
Yeah, it's good. she's definitely the only woman in it.
Yeah.
But
Kevin Spacey's in it, right?
It's Yeah, barely. It's more. Zachary Quinto and Jeremy Irons has a big moment.
Yeah. I feel like Penn Badgley.
Yes, Penn Badgley.
They put a lot of Kevin on the cover of the movie.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, that was when you marketed him,
right? I don't know what you would do with him at this point.
Where's that memoir?
Where's that memoir?
Well,
in the garbage, please. Yeah,
I'd read it.
I'd read it.
I would.
And I'd read a Bryan Singer memoir.
Yeah.
Okay. Well.
I mean, I wouldn't buy it. I would torrent it.
I would download it illegally. Though,
posthumous. Because, right. I don't want to see
any memoir from either of them would send them to prison.
I don't want a publicity tour.
Yes.
You know, I don't want you on my screen.
Yes. I want them to die, and then I want to read.
You can write a college
journal like Amanda Woodward in Melrose Place. 100%.
Exactly. Exactly.
All right. I've decided to forgive you both.
Okay.
I thought you were ghouls for a moment.
No.
I wasn't about to be like, I still stand Kevin Spacey. I flew to Italy to hear him read poetry.
No, we didn't. We would never.
I like the idea of a movie like St. Elmo's Fire, where it's just a bunch of like, which of these people is going to be super famous? The answer is four of them. You know, I like jump off point movies.
Right.
There was a lot of sax in that movie.
Mm-hmm.
That movie is god awful.
Yeah.
You hadn't seen it before.
No, I saw it in college.
Oh, okay.
And I was like, what the fuck is this movie?
I was a kid when it came out, and all I remember, the most iconic thing is her room. Her room is like this hot pink.
Yes.
And that was iconic.
Isn't there a scene where she's like crying on the floor, sax blaring, like the
curtains
billowing?
That's why I literally painted my bedroom pink when I was in my 20s,
like,
that same color.
Is this Suspiria?
She's like literally iconic, though. For women, back then it was all about blondes. It was all about like this, like like that. And she was a raspy, you know.
Right.
Brunette.
Pre-Winona.
Yeah. You know.
Here's a thing I want to ask. Talking about how she discusses sexuality and et cetera.
Yeah.
I want to know what you think of her response to the Indecent Proposal reviews. Because she talks about how when it came out, people were like, oh, this is the year of the woman, but you know, it's also about the year of buying women. And it's like, it says, you know, Robert Redford is basically just sort of like raping her in the movie,
mm-hmm.
because it's like he's paying for her. But she talks about how with the childhood and like her mother like selling her off to the mm-hmm. man who raped her when she was younger, she finds the movie empowering because it's a woman on her own terms deciding to have sex for money.
I think
her reasoning behind it did not shock me.
No, right. But one thing that complicates this is that the movie sucks.
Right. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And I think the timing of it with the market being what it was at that time, also, I think I like that it created conversations about would you?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I think any movie that is capable of doing that, this is in an era before social media, and that you were able to sort of draw out these conversations that got people playing around with, like, you know, gender roles. Like, she's going to have to save us by putting it out.
That movie is a Black Twitter Twitter question.
Yes.
Would you sleep with a man for this much money?
I mean, would you?
Yeah.
Yes.
Do we have any final thoughts on Demi's memoir?
I really hope this gives us a demi-sance.
Yeah.
You know, I feel like she's earned... It's not even about earning it. She deserves it.
Oh, final thing. One of my favorite anecdotes in the book was talking about being on the set of A Few Good Men and how one day it took forever for Jack Nicholson to come out of his trailer because he knew in advance Magic Johnson was going to announce that he was HIV positive.
Yes. And he had to go and watch it.
He had to watch it.
Because he's such a Lakers fan. Yeah.
Yes, he has spies in the Lakers. But also, you knew he was going to announce he was HIV positive, so why'd you need to watch it?
Why'd you need to watch it?
It wasn't a game.
Right.
It wasn't like...
What did he think was going to happen?
Yeah. I really would love to be a fly on the wall of him watching that.
Just that, like, My Week with Marilyn biopic. Like, 6 days of Jack Nicholson in his trailer.
My Week with Magic Johnson's HIV.
Oh, God. I just want to know.
Sounds like Jack.
The thing is like, that's still an era. The when she was working, when she was at the height of it, was the height of when you can clearly do whatever those are the stories I love the most. The 80s, early 90s when people were really
unhinged.
There were so many stories in the book. I mean,
because there was more money. It wasn't
basically, her career happened because the producers liked her and paid for her to go to rehab.
Yeah.
So that she could be on set of the fucking movie. And it's just like the idea that
Joel Schumacher was not like, having it.
But the
this
fact
is
that Joel Schumacher.
St. Elmo's Fire, yeah.
Yeah. Pre him being like, oh, I'm going to put you in rehab so you can do St. Elmo's Fire. It's just like the idea that you were putting so much effort into an actress who has a drug and alcohol problem.
Same thing with Melanie Griffith.
Yep.
And mm-hmm. on Working Girl. Yeah. They, you know, like, and the thing is like these women have been afforded opportunities that not many get, you know, to have a man be, you know, be so empathetic to your plight or your situation. I feel like her career sort of is parallel with Melanie, with all the, you know, the famous husbands, the children, the wanting to be a mother, sort of being, you know.
Well, mm-hmm. I will say that they both have minds for business and bodies for sin. All right. We'll be right back with Miss Gia Tolentino. Gia Tolentino, I am so excited.
Thank you guys for having me on Keep It.
Oh my God, of course. Yes.
I just want to say the name Trick Mirror and just like the cover is so 70s that every time I look at it, I keep singing Music in the Mirror from A Chorus Line. And that's probably just me.
This was the intended thing you wanted, right?
Well, I didn't realize till... Like, so I'm from Texas, and I'm from Houston, so most people from Houston don't have Texas accents. Like, my parents aren't from Texas, but I realized after I sold the book that I can't say mirror properly. Like, I say it like mirror, you know, like I say trick mirror. Like, I can't say it like mirror or whatever.
Mm-hmm. I love your guesses like, oh, as to what fuck, mirror I've sounds sold... like.
Wait, how do y'all say it?
Let me see it. Mirror.
Mirror.
Ira kind of says it, yeah. So, Lewis, you say it kind of like I do, mirror, like one word.
Mm-hmm.
Like, anyway.
Lewis is from the Hicks.
Yeah, the cover is very 70s.
Yes, I love it. I love the cover. I love the words. I mean, I knew I was going to love the words because you are a fantastic writer.
Thanks, man.
And I always love reading your writing.
Thanks, dude.
Yeah.
Ira and I were just comparing favorite parts of this book. I'm going to jump into the part about literary heroines and your relationship with them. Can you just talk about?
Oh yeah.
Can you just talk about like you? First of all, you clearly have read everything. First of all, just the sheer amount of like characters you cover in this section is so sprawling. But just talk about what led you to reevaluate how you absorbed these stories and how you kind of resented the implication that you should relate to them, and just how you, you know, what you've taken from reading all these stories.
The thing about this heroine's essay, in all the conversations about representation and pop culture and, you know, identification, I've never felt connected to any of that. Like I never had the impulse to be like, am I a Carrie? Am I Samantha? Am I a whatever? I never connected to the, you know, which Little Women sister are you? Like all of that. I never had the impulse to try to see myself in anywhere in pop culture. I knew that there were two things that went into that. One, it was absolutely a racial thing. I still have never seen anyone on camera really ever that's anything like me or had a life anything like mine. And it's partly because my life was kind of particular. Like my parents are Filipino, but I grew up in Houston in the suburbs. And I think it never even occurred to me as a possibility that I could be represented. And as a result, like I have not needed – I've sort of developed this thing where, you know – I can understand pop culture representation as an important issue and not personally relate to it as something that I have needed to build my sense of self. And so there was that, and there was also the fact that there was something about me that didn't want to identify with these narratives about women for specific reasons that I thought that I could identify if I went back and read basically all the books about the sort of canonical heroines from Laura Ingalls to – you know, Esther in the Bell Jar to, you know, Anna Karenina. And there was this thing about the trajectory of literary heroines. And yeah, I just read constantly as a kid. I still read constantly. there was this thing, there was this journey that they went from these brave, plucky, like super adventurous girls, and then they would get to be teenagers, and they would, the story would become about how they were really beautiful and they were really desirable and they were so depressed, and, you know, the future was opaque and mysterious and like sexy but scary and bad. And then they would get older and then they would get married and they would become bitter women who were trapped by the economics of marriage or by infidelity or whatever. And then often they would die, like in The Age of Innocence or Madame Bovary or Anna Karenina, like all of these stories, or The Awakening. And I was like, what is it? Why is this the trajectory of literary heroines? Why is it that I only identified with these girls? I was like, am I like, you know, is this a case of like severe arrested development? Like, am I super childish? Like, why is it that my identification stopped short in pop culture when I was about 7 years old and just never? And it was just this idea of like how the, you know, the narratives we look at, the narratives we read shape the narratives that we develop about our lives. It was also just really fun to read all those books again. You know, like maybe it was like that maybe the essay was just a pretense for me to get to read all that shit. Mm.
I did not write an essay when I reread all the Goosebump books, so at least you did something.
Did you really?
Yes, I reread them.
Oh my
Were they
gosh.
Scary?
Some of them are scary.
Some of them are really scary.
Oh, dummies are, historically scary. I remember Be Careful What You Wish For is a particular Goosebump. This is what you wanted to talk about, right, Gia? Okay, anyway, Yeah.
No, I was always scared by the ones, like any Funhouse clown adjacent, like that stuff was so fucked up for me. Have you guys rewatched Are You Afraid of the Dark at all?
Yes, the clown episodes are the scariest ones of Are You Afraid of the Dark.
It's still scary?
Yeah.
Okay, that's what I thought.
Yeah, the one with the clown in the Funhouse.
Yeah, and the one where the girl gets, like, shrunk down, you know, and, like, lives in the little dollhouse. Is that, like, that one scared the shit out of me.
That scared me because not only was she trapped in a dollhouse, but she lost human qualities. Like, she became porcelain.
Yeah.
And, like, she was in a very kind of American Doll outfit, so she was just losing any semblance of humanity. Wow, yes.
I'm really surprised they haven't rebooted Are You Afraid of the Dark, honestly. Like, they're rebooting all this dumb stuff, and it's like, you know, give me some more of that. Like, I'd watch it.
Yeah, and I think mostly some of them are just dumb. Like, there's one episode where it's based on the fact that Native Americans don't like having their pictures taken because it can steal your soul.
Right.
God, are you kidding me?
And this girl is just horrified of having her photo taken.
Oh, no. That's so... Yikes. I don't remember that one. I remember also there was like a... It was a Goosebumps maybe, or it was like Fear Street, where like something... It was like a toilet-based monster. It was like something would jump up through the toilet hole and like attack you. And I remember like I couldn't sit down to take a shit for like a year when I was like 7 years old.
I do remember a Goosebump book about a sponge that was
It Came
alien.
From Beneath the Sink. Yes. I remember it well.
What?
It was called It Came From Beneath the Sink. And it was an alien sponge.
This is when, like, we're getting into, like, the 30th or 31st book, and R.L. Stein's like, what if we, you know, like made the sponge a little frightening?
Like, one called Vampire Breath. It's like, you're really...
He's looking around, like, he's just like, what do I got? Yeah. He's a water bottle.
These curtains are kind of scary.
Do you think he wrote all of them? Yeah.
You know, I based on how present he is on Twitter, I feel like...
Like, maybe,
he must have been pretty with it, you know? I don't know.
There are some things that novels are really incredible at doing. And I think that, like, notoriously, fiction is really bad at being sexy. And it's also really, it's hard to find a really scary book.
Well, don't tell E.L. James there have been a couple...
But you know what I mean? Like, like books are, it's really hard. Like, it's... almost all famous fiction writers are pretty bad at writing sex. And it's hard to write sex, and it's also really hard to be scary. There was this book called Fever Dream by a Spanish writer named Samantha Schweblin, and it was fucking scary as shit. Like, it's like a single-sitting novel, and I was so scared by the end of reading it, and I think they're adapting it, and it's going to be great. But it's like, I admire those books for actually being able to be scary. And I don't only think it was because we had undeveloped minds as children. Like, if you read them recently and thought they were scary, maybe I should take a look.
Do you think there's something in the idea just of the way we read books then and the way that you write books that makes it easier for just sort of sadness to be something that really resonates in a book?
Part of what I was writing about in that heroine's essay is that men, like great male protagonists, like the one we think of as, you know, you'd have to read like Ernest Hemingway in school and you would be told that he was working out the human condition, right? Like Gatsby was about like this existential situation, the swimmer in the Cheever story, like Raymond Carver's, you know, protagonists, like all of these things would get talked about. They're men. it's about what it is to be alive as a human. And then novels about women, they're like, they're not about transcendence and, you know, the experience of being alive. They're about what it is to be a woman bounded within really specific social conditions. Mm-hmm. The novels are really good at expressing these sort of questions of existence in context of society and systems and culture, because those things are like they're sort of accumulative, right? Like it's like why everyone was calling The Wire novelistic all the time. It's because it takes a long time to build the context that's required to express this sort of stuff. But fear and, you know, horniness, like that is sort of just a sensory, almost pre-verbal, non-verbal thing. Mm-hmm. And that's why I think it's so hard for people to write well.
Yeah, I thought that James Baldwin wrote really well, like sex scenes in another country. And I really feel that, I don't know, as teenagers, we're done a disservice by the books that we are supposed to read in school.
Oh my God.
So many things I love.
What was the worst thing y'all had to read in school?
Oh God, that's a good question.
I mean, is it still Catcher in the Rye?
I hate Catcher in the Rye.
That is sort of the definition of like, you're supposed to identify with how conversational it is, and then whatever, you get 2 years older, or you realize it immediately at the time. This guy is so fucking annoying. Like, why would you assume I relate
to
this
person?
He's so annoying. Yeah, right. Takes a second to realize it.
Yeah. Did y'all have to read a separate piece?
I did not.
This book radicalized me because it was so fucking boring. It was also like, it's so gay in my like, you know, repressed Bible. Like, you know, we like weren't allowed to speak the word gay out loud at school. Mm-hmm. And like, And my teacher, like, I kept being like, is this book about their love for each other sexually? You know, and my teacher was like, gee, that's blasphemous, you know. The book was so boring. We spent so long on it. And my teacher wouldn't talk about the only part in it that was interesting. And I was just like, man, you know, if it's possible that we have to talk about this boring shit for 6 weeks, you know, it's like, then anything's possible in this world. Like in all these books, like, I did that, like, by the book New York Times questionnaire. Mm-hmm. And one of the questions they asked was, if you could make a book, like, required reading for anyone under 18, what would it be? And I said this book, Random Family, by Adrienne Nicole LeBlanc. It's like she followed this one family in the Bronx for 10 years. And it is, like, it's so full of, like, desire and violence and just family dynamics. And it just – so it's, like, the best book about the criminal justice system I've ever read. It's just super spicy, and it's super, super devoted and empathetic. And it's, like, I think about, you know, reading All Quiet on the Western Front, you know? I'm just like, what? Mm-hmm. Like, I read so many books about, like, you know, men at war, and it was like, why, like Chaucer, why did we read Chaucer? I like still can't understand Shakespeare, you know what I mean? Like, I would still need that No Fear Shakespeare to, it's like, why were we reading that in 10th grade? I like literally can't understand it now.
Right. I feel like what connected me to like Shakespeare was college, when I switched from my English major to theater. Because that is Shakespeare, it's theater, you know, you're supposed to be like living it, talking it, you know, thinking about the fact of us reading Julius Caesar in freshman year. I'm like, what the fuck is this book?
Yeah.
It's also
so weird to sandwich in Shakespeare with, you know, contemporary literature, which was just, I felt like in English classes, we just read one right after the other. And you basically need, you need to be taught to read Shakespeare. You need like a month beforehand to learn it.
Yeah, you need
a
really
good
teacher.
You know?
Or how many of us and our development as writers was stunted by the insistence that Ernest Hemingway wrote perfect sentences?
No, exactly. Oh my God. Like, one of the things that I have been most grateful about, you know, in recent years, and specifically as it pertains to my life and as it has pertained to the reception of this book, is that finally, like, we are no longer seeing, like, you know, it's just this thing where we all grew up and this, like, the straight white male experience was framed as, you know, an explanation of what it was to be a human, right? Mm-hmm. And everything else was special interest. And I think as a, you know, in high school, just reading story after story like this, I just, all of this discontentment was bubbling in me that our points of views are no longer a special interest, you know, in a lot of ways. Like with this book, one thing that I was thinking, like one of my only secret goals for it was I wanted to write a book that was mostly about women, but that wouldn't be framed as like, you know, here's a feminist thing that you can choke down to take your medicine, you know, like something that was about women but wouldn't be talked about like that.
Yeah.
It would just be like, it's about women, but it's more than that. It's about being alive right now. But almost all of the book is about women, kind of. And I think it was part like, my desire to try to do that came out of just like so many, just like, you know, like, yeah, Nick Adams fishing over and over and over.
The special interest thing, you know, just an aside, is so interesting to me too, because I feel like as a kid, a person who loved going to the library, loved going to the bookstore, like I lived at Barnes & Noble, right? As like a young, like black and gay kid in Milwaukee, it felt very uncomfortable going to the sections where those books that you might be interested in were. It's like you didn't want to be seen perusing the gay and lesbian section.
Right.
You didn't want to be seen in
the
black
section. Yeah, I was just talking about this at Barnes and Noble,
yeah. Yeah, it's like, oh, you're only going to read black books? Like,
I also remember the gay and lesbian section at Barnes and Noble being exactly one, like, six shelf thing, and it was next to, like, Christian thought, you know? It was about that big, you know? also, speaking of Shakespearean level things, I did not know you had reality television in your deep past, and
I do.
I was very fascinated at you reviewing yourself on this show that aired on the Noggin Network when you were a teenager.
I watched Noggin all the fucking time.
Did you watch Degrassi? Did you watch Degrassi? You watched Daria?
Yes, I watched Degrassi. I watched Daria, and I'm pretty sure I saw this show.
The show is, I think my year was like kind of boring. But so this reality TV show called Girls vs. Boys Puerto Rico, four guys versus four girls in Puerto Rico. It was like Real World Road Rules Challenge, but we were all 16 to 18. And one thing about that show was I had never before been able to drink freely. I fully gained like 15 pounds in like 4 weeks. Because it was like I was just like, you know, you're 16 and you can have pina coladas all day. Like, it felt like a miracle.
Right.
But I filmed the show in 2004 and I never watched it because I think I could feel this age of self-broadcasting cresting. And I think I knew that I would participate in it forever. And I was like, oh, this is, you can get away with something here. You can have done something really stupid and never really have to face the consequences of it. So I never watched it. And then I was like writing a book. I was thinking about writing a book about self-delusion and, you know, the construction of the self in these systems of contemporary life. And I was like, oh, God, I did this show. I have to, like, I remembered I was on the show. And I watched it all, and it was nuts.
When I think of reality TV, I still, generally speaking, think of people in their 20s misbehaving. You know, it's The Bachelor, it's I Love New York, things like that. But really, at the time of my life when the appeal of reality, I would have wanted myself to be on a reality show, probably would have been as a teenager when I was, say, getting into drama club, et cetera. So it's very interesting to see somebody who actually did it as a teenager and how, you know.
Yeah, the native narcissism that's universal to all of us as teenagers, I think it's really. And also, like, when we were teenagers, it wasn't, you know, like, reality TV hadn't turned into what it is turned into now, right? It was still a novelty, you know. So I re-interviewed everyone I was on the show with, yeah.
Yeah, I love those interviews with those people, especially the girl who just sort of works at Whole Foods and just seems like she has
Paris, the one that we bullied.
Yes, Paris, the one you bullied. But like the way she still talked was in like reality TV ready sound bites. So it's like, of course, there are those people who were sort of the prototype for what would become the way we talk. Or it's just they learned it from being in that environment. And it's why you can always just sort of go to some small town, right? And just sort of like pluck out people, and they fit the mold for reality TV so well. I mean, speaking of kids' reality shows, I was obsessed with The Paper, that MTV reality show.
Oh, sure.
Mm-hmm. I never saw that. What's The Paper?
The Paper was...
It was about a high school paper, and it aired in about, I think I was graduating college at that time, so it was probably 2008.
Yeah.
But it really got into...
Cypress Bay High School in Weston, Florida, and it was just about the four senior editors of a school paper, and cameras followed them around.
I mean, it just, there's no dorkier conceit.
The bold type.
Yeah, the bold type, yes.
And but, also, like, so much worse.
It's like kids with notepads running around the football field getting quotes and stuff. You know, Harriet the Spy,
wow,
to throw in a reference
I've
you made
got
in your
to
book.
Watch yes. this.
Yeah.
If you guys could have been on a reality TV show, what would you have wanted to be on?
Well, what's weird is what's still on my mind is Ira and I have a mutual friend who won the show Big Brother. Mm-hmm. And
I still want to be on Big Brother.
Yeah. Unfortunately, it is. I mean, here's what I need. It's not that I need my cell phone. It's that I need Wikipedia. So to be away from that for 4 months would truly be the end of me.
Yeah.
Wasn't there that thing with Big Brother? Like, didn't they like not tell them for a day that 9/11 had happened?
Yeah.
Isn't there that story?
I mean, I still remember the Real World season where they saw 9/11 happening. Like they let them watch the TVs the day of.
Both of y'all Big Brother, huh?
Yeah.
That's so funny.
Oh, no. Another one of Lewis's favorites. I would kill to be on The Mole.
Oh, I missed The Mole terribly.
Oh, yeah. Same.
Yeah.
Same. I also, like, of course, I wanted to be on, like, Legends of the Hidden Temple. You know, like, yes. I think that my...
Olmec.
All of us were... Yeah, exactly. Oh, fucking Olmec. I actually found the, remember how scary it was when the tree's hands would pop out?
Oh, yes. God, yeah. So Wizard of Oz, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Like, that I still find really scary. I think all of us on this reality show, like, we were close enough to being children that we, like, some of our challenges were kind of Legends of the Hidden Temple. You know, they were assembling sort of, you know, Aztec puzzle, like, you know, super racist Aztec puzzle pieces, I'm sure, you know.
But what would you be on now? If let's say you had to be on one today, what would you be on, Gia?
Well, so the thing is, I don't watch any reality TV. Mm-hmm. I would get stoned and watch Shark Tank like constantly for a while. And then Bethany Frankel went on and I was like, I can't. And but I've never seen The Real Housewives. I've never seen Bachelor or Bachelorette. Never seen Vanderpump, like any of that stuff. And so the thing is, it's like, yeah, if I was conventionally attractive enough to get cast on Bachelorette, and, you know, now I'm like way too old, but I have always like... One of the things that I like the most about being a journalist is that it just gives you a way to just plop in somewhere and see something. Like, I would love to be, like, a mole on The Bachelorette. Like, I would love to just somehow trick them into, like, I'm dying to know what that show's actually like. You know, I loved Unreal. I've never seen the actual Bachelorette. Mm-hmm. But, you know, like, I really want to know what those shows are like when you film them.
Yeah. I want to say that, you know, your book is also called "Is Trick Mirror Reflections on Self-Delusion," and what I really liked was what you wrote about just how we all interact with each other on the internet, and how that phase of—I mean, as someone who used to work at BuzzFeed, right—and I remember the days when they were telling us, you know, your post can't be a hater, you know, you got to be happy, you know, you always have to love something, right? And now about how the internet now, it just thrives off opposition. It makes me just really think about, like, what are we all even doing on social media anymore? And I really like how in your book you're able to write about how we use the internet today.
I think that we're all part of this generation that, you know, like, our lives will always be, we came of age when the internet did. I mean, it's literally the, you know, the pulsing organ through which the entire, like, through which every other thing in contemporary life is routed, you know? It's just, like, it's the beating heart at the middle of everything now, and it's also such a nightmare. And I think people that do really well on the internet, and I've been thinking a lot I've been doing a lot of book self-promotion, and I've been thinking about what makes people suited to these mechanisms of self-surveillance and self-promotion. And I've been thinking about how long I have been taking to these things without even noticing it, like as with that reality TV show. But there's also something about the internet, the way it's structured. I mean, these companies that are built on monetizing attention, they are profitable the more irritated and angry and frustrated we are. And there's a way in which that's kind of working into interpersonal interaction where the people that are thriving on the internet tend to be people that are really good at dealing with opposition, you know? Mm-hmm. They tend to be people that are really good at... And I think that there's some people that do this really well and for the right reasons, and there are also some people, you know, like our fucking president who, you know, use this ability to kind of be a wrestling character with their opposition, and they, you know, you can use it to some literally, like, you know, world-destroying ends. And, yeah, I think that the shift from the internet being organized around affinity and, you know, as much as I don't miss, like, the Upworthy era, like, I think even earlier when you think about the 90s, you know, or, like, times when the internet was oriented around discovery and surprise and affinity, the shift between that and it becoming, it's, like, driving force being that of, like, vicious opposition. Mm-hmm. I think that's basically, in that essay, I was just trying to figure out why the internet used to feel good and why it feels so bad now. And I think that that's one of the huge reasons why.
Yeah.
And also, like, ourselves, our identities are not meant to be monetized to this degree. Like, I think that's one of the things that makes us all feel like, what are we doing? It's like the internet takes this amazing thing, which is just humans trying to figure out who they are and just trying to be alive. And it monetizes it in 95 different directions till, you know, there's this low-level feeling of kind of, like, unsustainability and panic, I think.
Yeah. If I can just talk. Also, just about the one thing I really connected with in the book, it's that, you know, it was the idea of, you know, I've been myself, for other reasons, I have been just sort of meditating on the internet and our place in it, and just thinking about even the fact that I feel like if I look back at the older days of, like, when I started on Twitter, like, at BuzzFeed, you know, and, like, when people started to know who I was online, like, I was not Tammy Lahren, you know, Tommy Lahren, whatever her name is, trying to be like that kind of opposition. But there was some sort of opposition, I feel like, in the way that I operate it, in the way that, you know, I would make, you know, like, wild jokes about some pop culture topic or, like, some joke that I know is going to go too far where maybe some people will like it, some people will be mad about it. And that's just sort of how you develop a personality and a person that people want to thrive off, either following or they follow you because they don't like you. And it's weird that we all just sort of have become a version of that to be successful.
I was like that too, being at Gawker, you know, working at Jezebel, which was under Gawker. I mean, it was the entire, you know, DNA of that website was built on being extremely kind of punchy and combative to some degree. And the thing is, like, that's with all of these things, it's like, there's something about that that's really important, right? Like, the internet is genuinely a really democratizing force because it allows people to punch up no matter who they are, right? It's like, it's that's the thing that allowed, you know, like, the, like, there's a reason that the internet has given rise to these sort of power toppling, you know, like Black Lives Matter and the Standing Rock protests, right? Like, the internet does, the way that the internet can put people on an equal playing field all of a sudden is also a really amazing thing about it. But it's also one of the reasons that the opposition principle has gotten so intense.
Last question. Did you ever watch the show Ghost Rider?
Oh, are you kidding me? I love that show. Okay. Oh, my God. I hadn't thought about that in years.
If we're talking about the internet and opposition, I feel like maybe in those early stages of internet, the first internet villain I remember was when Julia Stiles played the hacker Mad Mouse. And she was terrorizing the school.
Oh, my God. Was she wearing something like a beret and a leather jacket?
She's wearing, like, a backwards cap and just, like, yeah.
Yeah, I'm picturing, like, Wesley Snipes. Like.
Yeah.
I love Ghost Rider. I had all the books of that, too.
Wait.
Yeah.
Me, too. Wait, Julia Stiles was in Ghost Rider?
Yes.
Holy shit. I don't remember that at all. Was she only on one episode?
Yeah, all their episodes were, like, to be continued, so it was, like, a four-part episode.
Uh-huh. Oh, wow. Wow, I gotta watch this.
It's on YouTube.
Thank you.
So look it up.
Oh, my God. Wow, I can't wait.
Our Ginger Rogers.
Yes.
Yeah.
Gia.
Yeah, I can't wait to see her return to the stage. Yeah.
Gia, thank you so much for being on Keep It. You know, I love you.
Thank you for having me on, you guys.
Yes, can't wait to see what you write next. I mean, because you're still at the New Yorker, so people can read your work there too. You can read more Gia everywhere.
Yeah, I'm overexposed right now, but I won't be soon.
Enjoy the rest of your book tour.
Thanks, y'all. Have a good one.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
And we're back with our Keep It Book Club.
I know. This literacy is just shocking.
We haven't talked about books in months. But anyway, the Washington Post stirred up some trouble for themselves with their review of Debbie Harry from Blondie's new memoir, Face It. The tweet they sent out was what people read before we even got to the wild review. The tweet of the review said, "In her memoir, Debbie Harry proves she's more than just a pretty blonde in tight pants."
There are already in that small sentence four things wrong.
Right.
First of all, every human being is more than blonde hair and clothes. What do you mean you have to prove that? What a crazy idea. It's like it's gaslighting in a way,
yes.
You know?
Also, the idea that a memoir released in 2019 was finally the proof we got that Debbie Harry wasn't just a pretty blonde. Mm-hmm.
When I'm watching her sing Heart of Glass in 1978, I'm like, I won't believe it until I read a career retrospective from her perspective.
Rapture? More like dumb bitcher.
Right? No, it's mind-blowing. What I said was, it's like saying, review, Marie Curie proves in her new memoir that she's more than just a slut with some beakers. It's like, you're the one choosing not to count up her obvious accomplishments, her obvious place in rock history.
Mm. She was the person who originally wrote Fade Away and Radiate.
That's right, yes. Silkwood showers well before they were popular.
Debbie Harry has not commented on the controversy, but
she
did share
is.
The tweet as publicity before it was called out online.
Yeah, she said, thanks for the review or something.
She ain't read that shit. She retweeted
it. Shit.
She doesn't know what Twitter is.
Nope. Doesn't even have a... What's a tweet?
And also, I was, in a way, sympathetic to the writer initially because... You know, sometimes, like at a newspaper, the person who writes the promotional tweet is not the person who wrote the article, so it could have been maligning what she said. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, I read the article, and there were only more, like, insulting comments about her.
The article is written like a high school thesis paper. It's really just bad writing in general. Like, hail the women of rock and roll, especially those who qualify for an AARP membership.
I mean...
What?
And she brought up, like, Patti Smith and Stevie Nicks and then said that. Just, what is that comment? Like, can you believe women got old? It's just a crazy non sequitur.
The lead to the review also. Even if Debbie Harry of the band Blondie isn't to your taste... Her voice too thin, her sexiness too blatant, her music too smooth. You can't dismiss certain truths about her. What the fuck?
Not to be super trite seeming or whatever, I truly believe that this may not be your taste as part of a review is almost exclusively a sexist comment.
Yeah.
It's the kind of thing you hear in a review of a Kathy Griffin comedy show. Like, this bitch may be too annoying for you. and therefore, just dismiss away. You're probably right. But for those who can stand her, it was an okay 90 minutes.
Jake Gyllenhaal may be too hot for you, but he can act.
Yeah. Also,
the
by the
critic
way,
was a woman, by the way.
I know, which is Sibby, even stranger.
Sibby, named Sibby O'Sullivan.
I have also another question.
Sounds like a Martin McDonagh villain.
Blondie isn't whose taste? Blondie is everywhere. When I hear Blondie, I don't think of punk. I think of being at the grocery store.
Yeah.
Right. You and I have talked about this so much before, and it was what prompted me to tweet out some Blondie songs that people should actually listen to, because I feel like Blondie is one of those bands that has become everyone's taste. There's Heart of Glass, there's One Way or Another. Like, these are songs that have been in movies and commercials, the grocery store.
Tons
like, you
of
hear
commercials.
Them everywhere, and... If that's all you listen to, you think that this is just Blondie, you know? I mean, I really became a Blondie fan in New York when I started listening to, like, their earlier, like, more punk-sounding albums, you know? And then, like, Plastic Letters and even that flop album, The Hunter, have really good songs on them, but you don't hear them everywhere.
Well, also, I mean, like, even if you just know their greatest hits, I mean, they're all, like, wonderful songs.
Yeah.
It's just they're not niche in any way, and this author is treating her like... I know she's really stepping out on a limb here, getting you to like her, but if you just give her a chance, you know, she's... I'm trying to think of somebody to compare it to. It's like saying the Bee Gees. That might not be your taste, you know.
I feel like they're diminishing the contributions based on some of these stories, a couple of stories she herself doesn't have clarity on.
Mm-hmm.
And that was my only issue with some of the you know, the review obviously is trash, but she's saying it may have been Ted Bundy, but that was debunked.
Yeah.
But it could be. And I was just
that wild story that she's told for years about how Ted Bundy almost killed her.
That she was just literally in his car.
Conviction that she believed that it was Ted Bundy. He had body. The only description she has is he had a small white car. He was kind of hot and he's had really bad BO.
Like, let me give you a story, Debbie. A lot of white men are just serial killers.
Yeah. And a lot of white men just have bad BO and small white cars.
I was going to say, she's just describing Silver Lake.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. That could have been anybody.
And people have debunked it by saying, I think she was in New York during this story, and that he allegedly was in Florida at that time.
But she's like, that was him, though. That was him. I know that was him.
Where is that Tarantino-esque rewriting of history movie?
Yeah.
Like a movie, Debbie Harry versus...
I mean, that car ride alone, you remember how they tried to make a film about post 9/11 when Elizabeth Taylor and Marlon Brando and Michael Jackson rode across the country?
And it was supposed to be Stockard Channing and... I forget who was supposed to play Michael Jackson, a white man.
Ray Fiennes?
Yeah. Joseph Fiennes.
Joseph Fiennes. Yes. Mm-hmm. And I don't remember who was Marlon. But it's like that ride she had with Ted Bundy, I'd watch like 2 hours of that.
Oh, yeah, right.
Of course.
You know, I would completely still watch imagined. The other film as well.
And at the end of it, he'd be like, you know what? You have a lot more than a pretty blonde in tight pants. I want to kill you.
Learned something today. We both learned something today. I won't kill you. We both learned something today.
Just to get back to what she is implying about Debbie Harry, I mean, she's implying that people really do think she was a worthless part of that band or that time. There's even a comment in the article where she says, but you can't deny that she was there or that she wasn't there. It's like, what do you mean she was there? She was a critical part of, punk and punk being popularized.
Why can't people just admit that they don't know something and give the assignment to someone who might be better at it?
Yeah, that's right. It comes off as uninformed more than anything.
You know what I mean? Like, this is the problem, then the biggest issue I have with, no offense, but like whatever's behind millennials, it's like, you know, we had to learn about stuff because our parents were old. So we had to know about things, even if there wasn't like a general interest in it. We sort of developed it because of the environments we were raised in. So like, if you don't know anything about Debbie Harry, there's so many things that you can pick up as a reference. The internet.
This woman is not young. Sibio Sullivan.
Then she's lazy as fuck. She's lazy, and you can't be working at Jeff Bezos's Washington Post with that kind of work ethic.
I saw when Prince died.
You know what he does to people with that kind of work ethic.
Right. Yes.
Doesn't pay them.
It doesn't pay them. It takes their health care away.
It makes them pee in a truck.
Yes.
When Prince died, somebody I know who I think is a writer for not like a Daily Beast, but a site like that, had some kind of glib tweet that was like, Prince may not strike you as a musician, but he really was a virtuoso of was sexuality. And I said, Prince played 2 dozen instruments.
Literally.
It's like, stop. What? What are you talking about?
About that? Sasha Stone.
It was very confusing at the time. But just, again, you're right. There needs to be more authority on this matter. And by the way, there are tons of people who have written definitive punk histories. So yes. These people were available.
The only thing that was interesting in the review is, and makes me want to read more of the book, is talking about how she categorized her own music as sort of a crossover between glitter, glam, and punk. And she was reluctant to sort of name disco as an obvious influence. Because she came up in the era, you know, where to be sort of legitimate, you had to hate disco music.
Yeah, you're saying punk and disco were usually at odds.
Yes. But her music is very punk disco.
Well, certainly Heart of Glass.
Heart of Glass, yeah.
One of the great punk disco songs is Rock the Casbah. I would say that is both punk and disco. Yes,
I'm here, and I like it.
But wasn't Rapture... Rapture was...
Oh, that's definitely disco, too. Yeah,
yeah, but they disco also hip-hop. Call it... they call it, like, rap. Like, it was, you know, the first time you heard a woman rap on a track. And
yes, yes. We have Debbie Harry to thank for Lizzo.
So this is literally... exactly.
I believe it's just also just the first rap... It was the first rap song to go to number one on the charts as well.
Some of the lyrics in that song are just downright hilarious.
I mean, and out came a man from Mars.
the amount of like...
Eat up scars where the people meet.
The amount of easy rhymes in a row.
Yeah.
It's very Dr. Seuss.
Yeah, face to face, man to man. Don't move too slow, girl.
I just feel like
I actually like that song.
I love
this
that song.
Woman actually got an opportunity to like sit with her. I know she couldn't. There's so many stories that Debbie must have because that was literally the best era to be in New York.
Well, she should come on and keep it.
She should come on and keep it.
Yeah, fuck
and just
Sibby.
Little fuck Sibby, but just to talk about 79 to 84 in New York. And it was marred by the AIDS crisis. But God, imagine if that wasn't a thing and how much more fun everybody would have continued to have. That was an amazing era just to be her.
The AIDS era was fun. Didn't you see Normal Heart?
I did see Normal Heart. It was a romp. It was not a romp. No, I just feel like, you know, she says herself in the book, you know, I thank God it wasn't, it was before AIDS.
When she talked about being her rape.
Yeah, her rape. Like, yeah. She was more worried about the guitars being stolen. I mean, again, like Demi Moore, there was these women, the sexual, you know, the sexual politics of being a woman growing up and being this age and being able to talk about sort of what they were going through as they rise to success. Sex was sort of like a, you know, it was annoying part of being a woman. And it was something that but it also felt like it was a tool and a thing that you kind of had to do to get by. And when Debbie Harry talks about she, you know, hated being raped, but the guitars being stolen, what hurt more, that just kind of like pushed my wig back.
That kind of does put you in, like, that time in a way.
Yes, you know? Exactly. Yeah. Exactly.
And New York in that era, too.
Yeah. Because where are you going to get those guitars again?
Yeah, because New York was also horrifying at that time.
Yes.
Are we done with the notion that disco is lame yet, would you say?
I think we've been done.
Okay. Yeah. I just want to be sure.
Have you seen Machina's, like, fall... winter resort line?
I mean, I'm just saying, like, gay men and women are all about disco.
But I think straight men, especially,
you think there's
like
still some
music
shame associated with
stuff,
it?
I think that people use disco so much as like an influence now.
Yeah, yeah.
But straight,
they appreciate it.
But did straight men hate disco? Because disco is where you went and got women.
Yeah. Well, I mean, there was certainly the backlash to it eventually.
Right.
You know.
Yes.
With
I mean, it was mostly a racist and homophobic backlash.
Right.
Yeah, right.
You know,
right.
it was like women and gay men and people of color like loved disco music and were at the clubs. Anyway, I will say that you should still be listening to Blondie. The albums are still good. Pollinator,
oh, yeah.
Which came out, is a great album.
I mean, Parallel Lines is the main one, but they're E to the Beat. Yeah, mm-hmm. Even their first one, Blondie, has Ripper to Shreds on it.
Yeah, yeah. I think that's still my favorite album of theirs.
The first one, yeah.
Yeah.
Iconic cover.
Yeah, and I saw them recently. They went on a tour with Garbage. So
that must have been fun.
Fabulous.
Yes. Amazing.
Oh, my gosh.
Amazing. Anyway, we'll be right back. And we're back with our favorite segment of the episode. Y'all, it's Keep It. Winter.
Oh, making me first.
Miss Winter Mitchell.
Well, I'm the guest.
You're the guest. We let you go first.
So my Keep It is for Iggy Azalea, who has reared her head again. I thought I did away with her. You know how I feel about her.
Well, you know, she pops up and then we get 6 more months of winter.
That's exactly what happens. She is being a hater again, which she's so incredibly good at. Lizzo's song Truth Hurts is 5th consecutive week, number one. Right behind it is like Camila Cabello's Senorita with her boyfriend. What's
Shawn
his name?
Mendes.
Shawn Mendes. Yes, that's his name.
Yes. They are paying a lot for you to know their relationship.
I'm very much aware.
Okay.
I woke up next to him this morning.
There's not a camera they don't love.
So, you know, Lizzo's doing what she's supposed to do. She's doing her promotion. She's doing her due diligence. She wants to sort of, you know, break those records. And if she does, then she'll beat Fancy, which is written by Charlie XCX.
Yes.
And sang by or rapped by Iggy Azalea. And Iggy
spoken worded.
Spoken
Iggy
worded.
Azalea.
Iggy did not take too kindly to the suggestion that she a record that she is clinging onto would be broken by Lizzo. So she has.
So what did Lizzo tweet?
Lizzo goes, y'all, all caps by the way. If we keep this up for 2 more weeks, Truth Hurts could be the longest female rap number one of all time. Right now it's Fancy. Can we do it? And she says, and by the way, Fancy's a bop. My friend Charlie XCX wrote it. Stream it.
Oh, how nice of her.
So nice of her.
I love a charitable Lizzo.
Yes.
She said stream Charlie's new album.
Charlie's new album. Right. I'm sorry.
Which everyone should stream. Because
100%. It's
great.
That
album is everything.
Fantastic. I love girl power. And Iggy, you know, loudly clears her throat and said, excuse me. But I believe that I was the one doing the heavy lifting. I'm not going to quote, actually go and give her Twitter any. I'm just going to paraphrase that I was the one who did the heavy lifting on Fancy and then implored all 15 of her fans to stream Senorita by Camila Cabello and Shawn Mendes.
You are going to have the azaleas
after
us on social media.
I don't give a damn. Wait till you hear my thesis about Azalea Banks.
They are angry white teenagers.
I don't care.
Angry gay white teenagers. They are the gay equivalent of Eminem fans.
If she really was encouraging people to stream Senorita in a sort of contentious yet sarcastic way.
She added it to her name,
yeah,
her Twitter name.
Twitter name is Stream Senorita.
Yes, inside, you know, before
Iggy Stream Senorita,
yes, exactly,
Azalea.
Yes,
guys, I think that's a little funny.
But that is,
I think it's a little funny. Unfortunately, it's a keep it to Winter Mitchell because Iggy Azalea is the queen of comedy. Lucille Ball equals Iggy Azalea.
Ooh, child.
Olivia Newton-John found dead.
Dead. She snatched that crown right clean off of her.
That actually is kind of funny. Iggy's true.
Just can you imagine? How do you drum up this level
of petty?
Petty. She's so petty.
Right. In a way, she's unafraid of being hated. She's like, bring it on.
No, she absolutely hates being hated. But she's like, if this is going to be the last moment, you know, every time she does something, I think she's wondering, is this it? Is mm-hmm. this it? Is this when I completely become irrelevant? Well, let me go out like... You know, on my own terms.
Mm-hmm. At least it's funny, and it's not her, you know, threatening to butcher someone with a knife like Azalea Banks.
Right.
Whenever she's mad at someone, it's like, I have to call the police.
I'm so scared whenever she goes off whatever she's not, you know, doing for her own self-care.
Go back to Rihanna's basement and eat some crackers.
Right. Or don't sacrifice anything. She loves to sacrifice things.
Lewis, what is your keep it?
My keep it is to a precious individual named me.
Because I thought you were going to say Gabby Sidibe.
No. Paula Patton, yes.
A precious individual.
Months ago, my keep it was to the idea of the movie Judy, the Judy Garland biopic starring Renee Zellweger, because the trailer at the time didn't really indicate what kind of movie it was. You didn't get to see a lot of Renee as Judy in it. And you just suspected that it would be a bland biopic, an unnecessary biopic. Well, it came out last weekend. In a way, the movie was getting kind of good reviews. It's getting like B reviews. I would say it is a B+, and her performance is fabulous. I say keep it to myself because I should have known that Renee Zellweger would not let us down. With the exception of the movie she won an Oscar for, I really love her as an actress.
Cold Mountain.
That's what I'm saying. Who's coming back to Cold Mountain?
Garbage.
Who's coming back to Cold Mountain? So this movie, the entire time I immediately am comparing it to Me and My Shadows, which is the famous long... Judy Davis take on Judy Garland and Tammy Blanchard as young Judy Garland, which is legendary because that movie is really about not just Judy's kind of tragic childhood, but her volatility as an adult and the tragedy, the pill popping, etc. This movie, it's right before Judy Garland's death in the late 60s, but it's not really about her as a tragic figure so much as it is about finding the tenderness within the Judy Garland we knew at the end of her life. And so we see her interacting with her gay fans and how it was her gay fans who sort of propped her up, built the legacy she has now. And the movie...
Just like Renee Zellweger.
That, you think so?
Yeah.
I guess that's kind of true. But Renee as Judy Garland, the electrifying part of the performance is when she's actually performing as Judy Garland, singing. First of all, while she is doing the actual singing, it never sounds exactly like Judy Garland, but you're never mad about it, which is a triumph in and of itself. Mm-hmm. But secondly, in this movie, something actually happens to you when you're watching it that the experience goes beyond entertainment because she captures her movements and glances in a way that it is actually... almost scary.
Yeah.
It's like a bracing feeling when you're watching this movie. And so I can't think of another biopic experience like that. Like if you think of Sean Penn in Milk, he's just amazing as Harvey Milk. But this one, there are moments when you are almost struck by lightning in how she captures Judy Garland.
The way she holds the microphone.
Yes, and like the microphone cord over her shoulder, these specific
movements
she captures.
Well, you never really believe Sean Penn could suck a dick, you know?
That's right. Well, honestly, in that movie, I did. I did. famously on the set of that movie, when he made out with James Franco, he texted Madonna and said, well, I just made out with my first man. And she texted back, congratulations. Anyway, Madonna is sometimes the best, sometimes. But I just want to say, you need to see this movie because I don't know of another biopic performance where you are actually jarred into wondering if you are entertained at all or just frightened.
You know, I want to see it. I'm excited to see it. I'm excited for a renaissance.
Sure.
Yeah.
I'm excited that this is good because What If was abysmal.
Which is a crazy thing that she would be in right before this.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. I forgot about that.
Also,
listen,
from
whoever is up against her for best actress, just send around DVDs of What If to the voters.
So rude. She don't deserve so nasty, so rude.
I would just be an interview.
She don't deserve that.
Oh, I love being in this category with Renee, you know. I just remember What If.
But from an Oscars perspective, let's say Renee Zellweger did win for this, a movie in which everyone unanimously agrees she's amazing, after getting an Oscar that was mainly just goodwill, it's an Elizabeth Taylor story for our times. Mm-hmm. The Butterfield 8 win, which people were like, Elizabeth Taylor's sick, we have to give her an Oscar, we'll just give it to her for anything. And then she won for Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf, which is one of the all-time great performances.
Yes, and Butterfield 8 is garbage.
It is the garbage.
Was she nominated for Chicago?
Yes.
Yes.
This would be her fourth nomination.
She deserved.
Was she nominated for Jerry Maguire?
No. She was nominated for Bridget Jones's Diary, Chicago, Cold Mountain, and now probably.
Jerry Maguire?
Definitely Judy.
She deserved.
Jerry Maguire, she did deserve.
I love Jerry Maguire.
That's my number one favorite movie. People can argue
with
me.
Is it really?
About it. Yes, absolutely.
I love Tom Cruise.
It's a perfect movie.
I'm sorry. I love Tom Cruise!
Yeah.
I like it. It's also a reminder of the time we really put a lot of stock in Jay Moore.
Can I tell you the Jay Moore
playing
story?
Playing by Heart, remember that movie? Anyway.
Remember
I loved his TV show, Action.
I did love that show. I do love Jennifer Aniston, him saying that, telling that story about how Jennifer Aniston, he overheard her complaining about how ugly he was on the set of Picture Perfect.
Wow. What?
It was very much like a, look at him.
Wow.
Wow.
That's crazy.
She should have offered him some smart water.
Yes. Yes.
Also, that's the worst movie. But anyway.
Picture Perfect.
Oh, man. Yes. Yeah. We could just talk all
Not
day
as bad
long.
As Butterfield 8.
Not as bad.
True, true, true. Yeah. Anyway, Renee, thrilled for you.
Yeah.
Kill it. Also, come on, keep it. We'll just ask you all the questions you need.
I would love to
sit
down with
Miss Renee. She's a sweet lady.
Yeah, she seems nice.
She's very nice. You should absolutely get her on here.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. We'll call her up, Winter.
We had a moment at Chateau. I'm sure she'd remember.
Okay. I will pretend to like What If.
I will pretend I finished it.
I didn't finish that.
I didn't.
Either.
I couldn't get past 1.5 episodes.
Actually, I love enough things that Renee's done that I don't pretend to like What If.
You
she probably didn't
that.
Even like it.
No, of course.
No.
We saw that. She shut up her set 5 days.
Maybe.
She's barely
She
in
was
it.
Doubling up, doing doubles to get through that.
My keep it this week is to Ryan Tedder of the underrated band One Republic.
Mm-hmm.
I love One Republic.
They have multiple eras, which is strange.
Yeah.
Yes. They have the Apologize era.
Mm-hmm.
They have Counting Stars, Rescue Me.
Mm-hmm.
And the song Secret, which I love because I will always remember it as the song that played when someone dragged Olivia Palermo on the city and she walked through the meatpacking district looking sad.
Yeah.
And Secret played.
Yeah. That seems apropos.
Yeah. Anyway, he was at Global Citizen, and he was being interviewed and said that on the upcoming One Republic album, he had recorded a song with Adele and Beyonce, and it would also feature Chris Martin.
Mm-hmm.
It's a lot of star power.
Obviously, the internet went wild.
Mm-hmm.
I was upset with the internet because they always take any opportunity to drag Coldplay.
Yeah.
And as we all know, I am in the Coldplay hive.
Mm-hmm. They're great.
I love Chris Martin.
Yeah,
sorry.
He's great.
I like him. I mean, I personally find him extremely attractive.
Yes.
Yeah.
You know? I'm like, imagine him and Gwyneth. That must have been just so clean.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
You know? I felt like, you know,
the amount of taupe in that house.
Yes. Mm-hmm. I felt like, you know, before sex, they probably like, you know, did like a face wash.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Like a cleanse, like a hot bath. I don't know.
They both sleep on their back in my mind. And like, you know what I mean?
Yeah. A lot of Reiki.
Yeah.
And it was a little believable, I guess, because he has won. Beyonce is friends with Chris Martin.
Right.
Okay. Yes. And Also, Ryan Tedder produced Halo.
So, in other words, it was feasible that all of these people would be working together. There's lots. Adele toasted Beyonce in her Grammy speech.
Right.
Yeah.
And then he went on Instagram and started sharing the story in his Instagram stories and then wrote, "Me utilizing, in quote marks, sarcasm, kidding, and a joke simultaneously," after he shared the definitions for sarcasm, kidding, and joke, and said, "Yeah, we have one song featuring Beyonce, Adele, and Chris Martin, but I don't want to talk about it or give too much away." In what fucking world does that sentence sound like sarcasm?
Yeah.
Also introducing the idea of this song, but then saying, "I don't want to give too much away," implies that you are working on this and you want to tease it out, but then we're going to find out more.
And you did it at Global Citizen, which is very me, because that is a festival designed to talk about
the globe.
The globe.
And also, correct me if I'm wrong, Ryan Tedder, not a noted comedian. So it's possible that this would be misconstrued as fact. You talking about music, which is what you do.
Right. So fuck you, Ryan Tedder. Being now mad at people, being mad at the media for spinning your statement into headlines.
Oh, no. You know what happened. He got calls.
Oh, Parkwood. Parkwood. Beyonce looked up from her phone.
Yes.
And said, "Jay.
Yeah.
What's the number for One Republic?" He was like,
"Blue Ivy, get them on the phone."
He was like, "You know, B, I don't know. I don't know." But then they called Parkwood, and Parkwood said, "Mr. Tedder."
Yeah.
"Stop it.
Please don't."
"Stop it."
And Adele was like, was smoking a cigarette.
And Adele was probably like,
post orgasmic blow with Skepta.
Adele wandering around her 90 room mansion.
This has been fun.
I'm going to say, I don't have to be amused by any of this.
Can I plug my podcast?
You have a new podcast?
Yes, it's called Waiting to Exhale. It's me and Karen Tongson talking about how we relate to pop culture now as opposed to the way we related to it in the past.
And it's Exhale X hyphen Hale because it's Generation X.
Generation X. And so we really sort of just go back and forth on nostalgia. It's very much about nostalgia and pop culture.
And Karen Tongson is her former co-host on Pop Rocket, who recently wrote a book on Karen Carpenter, which is so fabulous that people should read.
Wow, that sounds like a very fun segment on 2020.
Yes.
Yes.
We made it into a podcast. Thank you.
I've been
no need to be nasty. A hoe's got to eat, too.
Winter.
Yeah.
Thank you for being here.
I really enjoyed
the Pop
it.
Thank you so much for being here.
There's no pop. We don't.
No, because Lewis was Pop Rocket. This feels like Pop Rocket was a sitcom in the early 90s that ended.
I'm still sore.
Two of the cast members reunite on.
Yeah. That's right.
Yeah.
So it's also like Circus of the Stars.
Yes, right.
Yeah, it's much more like that.
Yep. Or just Circus.
Circus.
Yeah. I wish we could have Battle of the Network Stars.
Ooh,
where's
I missed that.
Battle of the Crooked Stars.
Oh, God.
Just doing relay races.
Yeah, right. That three-legged race against whomever. Aaron, Gloria, Ryan. Yeah.
All right.
Thanks,
Winter. Thanks, Gia Tolentino. That's our show. Keep It is a product of Crooked Media. Caroline Reston is our producer. Our editor is Sarah Barrett, and Kyle Seglin is our sound engineer. Thanks to our digital team, Elijah Cohn and Nadine Melkonian, for filming and editing our video content every week.